coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly, our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year. On today's episode, we will survey the lessons for the 13th Sunday after Pentecost, according to Series A of the 3-year series lectionary. And the lessons are Isaiah 51 verses 1 to 6, Psalm 138, Romans 11, 33 to chapter 12, verse 8, and Matthew 16 verses 13 to 20. This is the gospel lesson, which we always begin with, and here is David Weber.
A key, it seems to me, is inconsequential compared to the gates of hell. The gates of hell were a terrifying image that captures the universal human fear of being locked up or locked out or locked in. A key is inconsequential unless the gates of hell can swing open once they are unlocked. And Christ links Peter's confession with the key that unlocks the gates of hell, which is the desire of every human being. Interestingly, I think Matthew recorded that this incident took place in Caesarea Philippi, which was also called Panias. It was kind of in praise of the god Pan. And it was the location of a sacred cave dedicated to the god Pan, which was thought to be the entrance into the underworld Hades. The gates of hell admitted traffic, except in Greek mythology. In rare instances, the traffic was only in one direction, into hell. The gates would never swing open to admit traffic out of hell. And as Hades has no exit, the gates of hell symbolize the very antithesis of what humans desire. Our desire for freedom, especially our desire for freedom for the fulfillment to live fully. So when Jesus promises a key to the gates of hell, he is promising the one thing needed to lift human beings, to transform human beings' lives out of despair into hope. In contrast, this key, which is connected to Peter's confession of Jesus as the Christ, the key is unimpressive. It's a commonplace object. In itself, it conveys nothing that could stand against the terrifying image of the gates of hell. Yet Jesus promised that the mighty gates of hell would never prevail against this gift of the key. So the question is, what is this key? And of course, the key is connected to Peter's confession. Now, let me just repeat, in Greek mythology, only in rare instances did any human being exit Hades. And yet that was the desire of all human beings. Hades was inferior to human existence. So for Jesus to promise a key for all mortals, not just exceptional mortals, not just a few mortals, and that key would prevail over the gates of hell, that would be Jesus calmed a deep fear buried within the soul of every human being that there is no escape from death. This key is our confession, that our mortality is somehow different because the God of heaven came to earth, that the man Jesus is the divine Christ, and that he is the Son of God, and the Son of God is incarnate on earth. That is the key. That's Peter's confession. By mere human light, Jesus would be considered nothing more than a great human being, like John the Baptist or Elijah or Jeremiah. But Jesus' salvation isn't for great human beings. A great human being wouldn't be able to promise what Jesus promised. And no human being, no matter how great, exit the gates of hell. For Jesus to donate this key, he would need to be God and man. And that key would have to be forged in his descent into hell and ascent into heaven. Now, obviously many are ready to accept Jesus as a great man, but that would have no power to calm our fears. The only thing that we can be content with is to receive this key, which he offers, because our fear of being locked out of life or being locked into death, that fear can only be overcome with the key that Jesus gives. So the confession is the key, because Jesus unlocks the mysteries of life's meaning. When we get to Isaiah, Isaiah promised that God's promise of rescue is the thing, the one thing that unlocks the mystery of life and gives us the comfort that we desire, especially when the floodgates open and all hell spews out its malice and chaos on earth. And when we get to Paul in Romans, Paul sees that even the depths of hell is where we will find Christ. Even that we will find that Christ's love goes even deeper. And then that becomes the key to our understanding that there is no place where we are separated from God. So for Christ to promise this precious key to all who confess him is to expand on this huge promise and offer it to all people everywhere and for all time.
Do you think this confession is just the confession of Jesus as the Son of Man, or can we include our confession of sins in this as well?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, what's said in the text is what's said in the text, and but if we cast forward to next week, even after Peter's powerful confession, he denies that confession in effect by trying to hinder Jesus from going to Jerusalem and suffering the crucifixion. And so, yeah, this is a confession of sinners, you know, and
yeah.
This is what I like about it, even though maybe not, you know, in pure theory, it's not. But this key is not given to great people. This key is given to sinners. And I like this because the confession then becomes the confession of someone who has no right to say they own this key or have this key or have this access. It's pure gift.
The confession of sins is almost implied, right?
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think that Matthew is doing this purposefully in calling attention to the Grotto of Pan. And because everyone would have known that the gates of hell is a one-way traffic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that image is utterly terrifying. I don't think we are terrified any longer by that image. They were, and it would have been absurd for anyone to say, oh no, the gates of hell will be irrelevant to anyone who has the key. And by the way, this key is being given widely to all who confess. That would have seemed beautiful in a sense, but foolish and absurd in a sense. So what I like is how nebulous it is this, what is this key? What is this thing that unlocks? I mean, obviously it's the confession that Jesus is both God and man. It's the incarnation. Isaiah looks forward to this and Paul looks back on it and sees that this key has wider application to the thing that unlocks the mystery and confusion of life. Now, using this psalm, as we've said, the psalm teaches us how to pray the truth of the gospel. And in this case, the psalm says more widely, not just the confession of Christ, but that God's word is the key, that the key to life is that God's word is made great. Because on the day I called you, you answered me, says the psalm. So in other words, God's word, like a key, does not appear to be great. There's nothing in which the glory of God's word seems glorious. God's word is made great when what God promises is fulfilled. That key becomes great when it actually does what it promises, is unlocking the mystery of life and the gates of hell. So God's word is made great when God fulfills what he promises. And especially by giving life, says the psalm, in spite of my enemy's wrath. And it's when God's word seems the weakest that it's at the moment of actually fulfilling the promise. So fulfilling what he has promised is God's glory. Now this, I'm going to kind of stumble on this. Because we usually think of glory as something obvious, an obvious success like a champion or a military victory. This isn't God's glory. God's glory is transformational. It is promise and fulfillment. But when it's in the stage of promise and not yet fulfilled, there is no glory in it. There's a lot of doubt about it. There's certainly wondering whether this promise will ever be fulfilled. So God's glory is not like human glory. It's different because even though the Lord is on high, says the psalmist, yet the lowly he sees. So it's God's glory to disseminate the keys to the gates of hell to all people. It's God's glory to lift up the lowly. So, and to be inclusive of the lowly, lifting them up to the lofty. So God's glory is not a static thing. It's a transformational thing. That it's God's glory to take the lowliest, giving them the key, and giving them the opening the door to the transition from lowliness of despair to the loftiness of the kingdom of heaven.
And that ties back to the incarnation, right? That Christ sets aside his glory to become man, and then by becoming man raises us up as well. So it's not just that he gives us the key, it's that he is, like you said, transforming us.
Oh, it's exactly. I mean, it makes the point better if we go back. It's that the key is much like Christ himself, and that at most those around him would admit that Jesus was a great man, John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah. But the rub came when Jesus claimed that he was true God, God in the flesh, and that's the only way there would be any key, is if the incarnation. But the fact is that Jesus does not come in a way that looks glorious. In fact, at times it looks inglorious. That's the ridicule of him on the cross. But the glory is not the static thing. The glory is the transition that Christ allows us, that gives us. And which means if it's going to be the lowly for a good amount of the time, it will appear as if Christ has no glory at all. It will appear as if the key has no ability to stop what is ruining life. Isaiah makes it pretty clear that God's not in a hurry. Jesus didn't need to be in a hurry because they are about forever. The arc of their of God's work is forever, and so in time, Jesus is not going to be worrying about looking to appear to have earthly glory. I kind of wish the church would remember that when it starts reaching for immediate success or obvious glory, that there is no hurry. And so long as we are confident in the promise. So the key to the meaning of life is to have a promising life. A promising life is a life that lives by a promise. And Isaiah says, here's the promise. My rescue shall be forever. There is no place at any time in which God's rescue is irrelevant. That is the one thing we desire. It's the one thing needful. And Isaiah waxes poetic here. We need this because he says the heavens are being scattered like smoke and the earth worn out like a garment and its dwellers like gnats die out. We are surrounded by death. The gravitational pull towards hell is in one direction. Things are becoming shoddy and worn, and it makes us, I mean, it makes us feel like we have no more significance than gnats as we die out without any, with no interruption. That's what God intends to interrupt, to transform, by his promise of rescue. And especially that promise seems weak when we see the power of unpromising despair and how pervasive and persistent that despair is. God's promises just seem like mere air. And so Isaiah says, look at these promises seem weak, but they have always seemed weak. And he says, consider the tradition of rescue of Abraham, your father, and Sarah, who spawned you. So in other words, that weakness of the promise keeps delivering and keeps people confessing the truth and waiting for God's promise. And then Isaiah says, don't look at the immediate. Just look how that promise has made lives promising, beginning with Abraham and Sarah, who, and then all who have followed, who have found comfort among the ruins. This is where the promise really shows itself. When everything proves unpromising, there is that comfort among the ruins to those who give ear to God's teachings. Now, this is, Ethan, this is where I keep coming back to. You know, we make these promises of God's rescue. And then, you know, if we get anybody's attention, they say, oh, okay, where do we get in on these promises? And we have to say, it's God's teachings. It's the stuff that we do, you know, week in and week out here at church. That teaching will seem as insignificant as a key, but it will prove to be a light to the peoples, is what Isaiah says. So I like the fact that there is a time in which these promises do not seem promising, in which the key seems inconsequential, in which Jesus Christ, true man and true God, doesn't seem to be at all the image of God and the glory of God. So while God's teachings may seem insignificant, they are the key to hope. They are the key that unlock the gates of despair. It is the thing which fuels our confession that because Jesus Christ, true man and true God, was present on earth, his real presence is the key. And that means, as Isaiah says, God's triumph draws near and his rescue comes forth.
As preachers, when it comes to God's teaching, how do we handle it when we have those people come up to us and say, how do we get in on it? And then they say, oh, well, what God says just doesn't seem very relevant or interesting to me. How do we handle that kind of situation?
We would like to be more impressive than we are. We would like to be more obvious.
I suppose it's the world trying to tell us that everything has to be interesting and grab our attention for it to be worthwhile. And that's what we're working against.
All right, I'll go back to an old tried and true formula. The Christian faith is both desire and discipline. Mm-hmm. We're not wrong that God's word ignites desire, but that desire is insufficient. It has to turn itself into a habit, a discipline. Minimally, it's just the regular worship where God promises to do the work. It's in the house of God in which the promises are connected. I don't know that it's right to even suggest that the discipline is desirable, except I have to say, the disciplines attached to being a preacher have been very desirable. I have enjoyed the language studies. I have enjoyed maybe more than I should have the investigation of these things. There is something that ignites desire when you're dealing with God's word. And of course, you know, we know from the greats that is, you see it running all through Augustine or Jerome, any of the church fathers all express this light that ignites interest. But it's not something that's predictable. It's a gift, and you can't schedule a gift. It's grace. When I find myself wishing that God's glory would be come out through what I do in a more obvious way, I just have to remind myself that I'll use the terrible metaphor. This is not a sprint. It's a marathon, and it's not in time. It's eternal. We will move on to Romans, because this is a passage that has been close to me for a very long time. And I think what Paul does is he ignites and elaborates and energizes what it means to have the key to existence. And Paul says he urges us not to be conformed to a dying world. A dying world is defined by its dying. And there are some brilliant things that happen when people resist dying. But finally, death is the event that our lives are organized around of trying to avoid for as long as possible. So Paul says that what the cross does is allows us not to be defined by dying, which is very strange, because the cross is where dying takes place, which is the irony or the paradox of the cross, is that it actually bestows a life which is not obvious. So don't conform to a world which is organized around dying, but rather be transformed. And then here's what Paul says: by the renewing of your minds, the steady, slow plod of practice and discipline, that there is a renewal that takes place. It's taking place in the mind, and the mind has to work slowly. It has to be deliberate. It can't be distracted by screens and other distractions. The mind is a thing which is renewed by focus. So it is God's glory to transform our lives, and he does it in an inglorious way inside through his teaching. It's not done in an obvious way or an overwhelming way. It's not a display of power. It's a renewal. And here's the interesting thing is all of these big, exciting things happen with masses of people. Paul says this renewal happens in the mind. The mind only exists in an individual. Someone can't think for you. Someone can't eat for you. Someone can't breathe for you. And in this case, God's renewal, God's glory is that he renews the individual mind who is engaged in the study of his word. I know it sounds, it's a big promise for what seems to be a small thing. So what this is the promise is based on that God's word is the key. This is what Isaiah was saying. Paul is making it explicit that it is this renewal of the mind through God's word that unlocks life's meaning, especially, as we've said, when the malice and chaos of hell are let loose on earth. And Paul is confident that anyone who enters the depths, Paul doesn't call the depths Hades. The depths have now been occupied by Christ, and there we don't enter into hell. Rather, we enter into that sphere where we discover the depths of God's wisdom and knowledge. Why are we transformed? Because our study is introducing us and leading us on in knowing God. That is the key. This is knowing God is the thing that is most desired. And by knowing, it's a rich and saturated term of not just having knowledge of God, but an intimacy of actually knowing God, that our whole life now every aspect of our life is a part of God's intent that we better get to, that we better know Him and desire His presence. So this promise of transformation promises a new alertness to the meaning of life. That when we have this, what we see in life is the goodness of God rather than Isaiah's vision of a dilapidated and sorry existence. There is goodness in this life that once we are no longer oriented to death, the goodness of God is evident, and we're being introduced to that goodness and being introduced to God through it so that our desire for the good will be fulfilled by our ever-increasing knowledge of God. And what Paul says, that this goodness, this is desirable, and it is the desire that our fragmented lives come to completion. That's what is opened up when we are given the keys that unlock the gates of hell, the keys of the kingdom of heaven.
Thank you, David and Ethan. And thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.